The digital age is here, the next generation has arrived. This is a Thinkers 50 podcast and I'm Stuart Craner. Today I'm talking with one of the chroniclers of the next generation and future trends, Don Tapscott. Don is chairman of the Engineerer Innovation Network and his books include Wikonomics, Paradigm Shift, The Digital Economy and Grown Up Digital. So you've written, you're on your 13th book now, Don, writing your 13th book. Most of them have been, virtually all of them actually have been really successful. But is there a theme which runs throughout all these books? What links them?
Well, there is a theme, although I have to be frank with you, they haven't all been bestsellers. I wrote a book in 1981 about the internet. I think my mother bought most of those. It was like a study in bad timing. And I've had some other stinkers, too. I wrote a book in 1995 called, it was about privacy. It was called Who Knows? Safeguarding Your Privacy in a Networked World. And everyone just shrugged their shoulders on that one. And Digital Capital came out the month NASDAQ crashed. It was this awful timing, too. Although the reviews of that book were extraordinary. Business Week said the book was pure enlightenment. It was the best review of a book I've ever seen in Business Week, but the timing was just awful. So anyway, the theme is very clear. For 30 years now, I've been arguing that there is a new medium of human communications emerging, and that this is comparable to the printing press in terms of its impact on the economy and society. And just as the printing press led to the obviation of all of the institutions of agrarian feudal society, and all these institutions basically took us forward to a certain point, but when the printing press came along and knowledge became distributed, they were no longer appropriate. A similar thing is happening today with the web. And back then, it was way back, you had the rise of parliamentary democracy. Of course, the separation of church and state and the Protestant Reformation came about because people had knowledge. The rise of medicine, the people concluded the church wasn't a good foundation for medicine. You had modern science, the creation of the university, the creation of the nation state, actually. And all of that was possible because of a communications medium. And today, we have the next evolution in that. And I'm convinced that every institution in society is being changed very profoundly. So that's my work. And of course, the corporation is the institution that we have chosen to innovate, create wealth, create goods and services, and it's going through a profound change as well. So management readers have been interested in my work for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose the irony is that you're writing books, which is the old-fashioned medium to chart the amazing changes in technology.
Well, it is absolutely ironic. And if I had my way, the books would be for free. The book is really the billboard for ancillary rights for me. You know, I'll make as a big bestseller. I'll make as much money on five speeches as I do on a top management book of the whole year. So and how would it hurt me to have my book widely distributed and more people reading it because it was free and it was digital? And of course, if the book was bits rather than atoms, it could be a very different value proposition too, rather than people having to follow my narrative, as fascinating as I may think that is.
Yeah.
The book could become a living, breathing document. And I've made some attempts to achieve that. The final chapter of Wikonomics was a wiki, and 1,500 people co-wrote that chapter, but it was never published. This is a funny thing, actually. My publisher said to me, "This is great. Why don't we publish a few new chapters of a new edition of the book?" And I said, "Well, I can't do that. It's the wiki's done under a Creative Commons license. I don't own the IP, and I can't exploit it commercially." To which my publisher says, "Well, why did you set it up like that?" I thought about it for a second. I said, "Hey, you're my publisher. You should like read the book." That if I create the definitive guide to the 21st century corporation through a new collaborative process, the fact that I don't own the IP wouldn't be relevant. But anyway, these are big changes that are underway.
I mean, you spend time writing, speaking, researching. You're involved with Engineerer. How do you describe yourself? Consultant, commentator, researcher, educator? Is there one label you're comfortable with?
Well, thank you for not throwing futurist in there. Because people often describe me as that, but I'm in no way am I a futurist. I'm a researcher, absolutely. and all of my work is based on research. I'm not smart enough to come up with a big idea by myself, so I do extensive research. The last few books have all been based on multi-million-dollar research programs. And these days, I would say, primarily I'm a change agent. I'm convinced that we're going into a period of very profound change. The stakes are very high, not just for business and corporations, but for this fragile planet. And I'm at that stage in my career where I want to be influential and I want to bring about change, and that's my main goal.
What's wrong with being a futurist?
Well, I'm of the view that the future is not something to be predicted. It's something to be achieved. Now, that wasn't my slogan. I don't even know who said that. But that, you know, predicting the future is of very little interest to me. Now, I suppose this futurist moniker came about because, you know, I've been describing how information technology and the web can change the way that we work and manage and live and play and probably even think. And in a sense, that has a predictive character to it, but that's really not my interest.
Are the signs that the organizations and managers who you communicate with are responding to the issues you raise in books like Grown Up Digital? Because in a sense, the audience for your books are actually the more senior, older executives in corporations.
Well, I got to tell you, it's taking a long time on this question of young people in the workforce, in the marketplace, and so on. As I think you know, Stuart, I started studying young people about 15 years ago when I noticed how my own children were effortlessly able to use all this sophisticated technology. And at first, I thought they were prodigies, but then I noticed
we all think our children are prodigies.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I noticed all their friends were like them, so that was a bad theory. So I started working with about 300 kids. And it was in 1997 that I wrote Growing Up Digital. That was a big book. It was actually the number one, not just management, but nonfiction book on Amazon. And so flash forward today, these kids are not just growing up. They've grown up, and they're coming into the workforce, the marketplace, society, and there's no more powerful institution or force to change all of these institutions. Exhibit A, they just elected their first president in the United States. Exhibit B, Iran. Demographics, biggest group of teenagers and 20-somethings in any country in the world, combined with the web and access to secular information equals huge change. And this is my thesis, of course, demographics plus technology equals change. And but, you know, when it comes to our institutions, we do the opposite. I mean, in the corporation, these kids, in their culture is the new culture of work. They're the smartest ever. At their fingertips, they have the best tools, better than exist in most of our corporations, for high performance and collaboration. What do? We stick them in a cubicle, try and supervise them, treat them like Dilbert, and then we ban their tools. We ban Facebook. Hello, social networks and blogs and wikis and jams and so on are becoming the new operating system for a corporation. What do? We ban them. And I was talking to the CIO of a state in the U.S. where the governor had banned Facebook. I said, why did he do that? He said, well, employees are wasting their time using Facebook. And I said, well, if that's true, is that a technology problem? You fix that by banning a technology? And he agreed. I said, what was the effect of banning Facebook? He said, well, everybody went to MySpace. I mean, this is totally the opposite of what we... In the marketplace, you know, here we have a totally new consumer. Biggest ever, by the way. Biggest generation ever. These kids are totally different. They don't want products and services. They want experiences. As for physical place, you know, the four P's, product, place, price, and promotion, you learn in every marketing 101 class. They don't want products. As for place, 62% of them, according to my research, we studied 11,000 young people around the world, 62% of them already know what they're going to buy before they go to a store. So the brand is changing fundamentally. It's not just an image or a promise. It's becoming a relationship. So what do? Rather than investing in the digital world and rethinking all of our marketing and plans and our whole value proposition, we do the opposite. We increase our advertising in traditional broadcast media. The gap between the amount of time that people spent online and the amount of time spent in the amount of money spent in the digital world is growing. It's not narrowing. So, and of course, you can extend this on. In the university, you got a new generation. They don't go to lectures. The smartest kids don't go to lectures. So rather than reinventing the model of pedagogy because they're trying to tell us something, we fail them, or we describe them as stupid or uninterested. You know, in the family, rather than using this new medium of communications to change family relationships, we do the opposite. We stick the computer in a public area where our 14-year-old 16-year-old, can't go to inappropriate sites, and we throw blocking software on. Well, did anyone notice that your 14-year-old boy has a computer in his pocket and that he'll see a dozen computers throughout the day? And so, we do the opposite of what we should be doing. It's actually quite frustrating for me. I have to tell you the truth.
Hmm. I suppose managers in corporations will say, well, what should we be doing?
Well, I laid this out basically in the book, and I described the sort of the seven themes of what we should do in the corporation and also in the marketplace. But just basically, when it comes to the corporation, there's some pretty obvious steps that companies need to take. I described in the book these eight norms of the net generation, and these should be the foundation of designing any work system if you want high performance, or designing any marketing program. Norms like freedom, collaboration, integrity, having fun, innovation, speed, and so on. I think we need to rethink authority. Hey, welcome to Dilbert Inc. I'm your boss. A boss is someone who's an authority on everything. Well, just a sec. The young person's thinking, I've been an authority on something really important since I was 11 years old. And it's true. This is the first time in history when children are authorities on something important. The old paradigm, you recruit, you train, you compensate, you retain, you manage, I think all of that is wrong. You shouldn't recruit them. You should initiate relationships at an early age using social networks. We shouldn't be training people in the traditional sense. Work and learning are the same activity in a knowledge economy. So there are many, many lessons that we can, basically, in their culture, the new culture of work, and if we listen to them, we can learn a lot.
It sounds like your themes are expanding even more broadly with your new book, the book you're working on at the moment, called Rebuilding the World. Would it be true, is that your most ambitious work to date?
Well, if I don't do this, who will? And this is the summation of my life's work, really. As I said earlier, I think our institutions have come to the end of their life cycle. The industrial economy has finally run out of gas, and this recession is not just a recession. I think it's a punctuation point in history. It's the convulsive shock that is slowly waking us up to understand that we need to change all these institutions. And you can go through them all. The corporation, Wikonomics talked about that. A fundamental change is underway in how we orchestrate capability to create goods and services and innovate. The old industrial model of government is failing. When it comes to global cooperation, our systems are based on the nation state, which is the wrong fit for the global economy. We've got science that's deeply flawed right now. I mentioned the university and the crisis that's emerging in education. Oh, did I mention the energy grid? It's not just that we're going to run out of fossil fuels. We're going to destroy the planet far before then. We've got, four decades to reindustrialize the planet. And if we decrease carbon emissions by 80%, not 8%, 8% that upset George Bush, by 80% in the year 2050, it'll still take 1,000 years for the planet to cool down. That's from Bill Clinton. So these are big changes. On the other hand, we have a new communications medium that enables a new model of all of these institutions that's open and networked and built to last, sustainable, and so on.
I suppose the surprising thing is that what comes through in your work is that you're still an optimist.
Well,
or perhaps not.
I'm hopeful that we can do this, but I'm starting to get very concerned because we are running out of time. Kofi Annan just had a conference in Geneva that I was speaking at on the climate change issue, and the smartest people, they don't say it publicly, but there's a sort of underlying tone right now that we may have, in fact, run out of time on this, that if we don't make radical changes, that there's going to be a lot of bad things that will happen. You're looking at 1.5 billion people losing their water supply in Asia in the next 20 years. And when you have these kinds of disruptions, it's hard to imagine the volatile and effect and centrifugal forces that kind of get unleashed in the world. I'm hopeful. I don't think I'd call myself an optimist at this point. I think our biggest hope and my greatest reason for optimism is I've studied this new generation, and they're going to dominate the 21st century, and they are different. They think differently. They have a very strong sense of integrity, and they care a lot about the world. And what they did in the United States with Obama was very impressive, and we'll see if that can roll out in other countries.
Yeah, do you have a sense that it's a global attitude and culture now?
Well, that's a great question, because this is actually the first global generation. The real shock to me about these eight norms is that, you know, with some variability, they exist all across the world. For young people who've had access to the web, of course, there are many who have not, but for those who have, they have a whole cluster of norms and values that are consistent across cultures, across geographies, and so on. And so that's a source of optimism when you consider the fact that we do have a global generation that might have the will. They sure have the tools. They might have the will to bring about some big change.
And when does the new book come out?
If I can get it done, it'll be out in February of next year.
Good luck with that, Don, and many thanks for talking to us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thank you.